Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, this is Craig Garber. When I'm not interviewing world-class guitar players, I'm busy helping clients with their marketing. In fact, since March of 2000, I've helped over 300 clients in 108 different industries all over the world sell everything from $20 books to $5,000 seminar seats and everything in between. I even authored a marketing book called How to Make Maximum Money with Minimum Customers. And now, I'm giving away a free marketing strategy session to business owners who qualify. On this call, we'll discuss what's currently working in your business, specific sales and marketing problems you're struggling with, and I'll identify specific strategies you can use to overcome these problems and increase your cash flow. To find out if you qualify and to book your free marketing strategy session with me, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/marketing right now. Again, to book your free marketing strategy session with me, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/marketing right now. Thanks for listening. Now let's get on with the show.
Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar. I'm with an incredibly cool and really unique and innovative guitar player. And he also seems like a guy who doesn't take any bullshit or give any bullshit. Or else maybe he's just a crotchety old man like me. We will find out today.
Get off my lawn!
Yes. We're with the one and only amazing Charlie Hunter. He's had a music career over 16 years and 20 albums. He's an incredibly unique player.
Oh, writer. Wait. Longer than 16 years?
Yeah, that's what I thought.
I'm 50. I know. I've been doing this since I was like 16 years old.
Yeah, so, that's what I thought.
I'll take that.
No. Let's fit 40 years.
I'm 30.
Charlie has been around. Yeah, I was looking at that. And I was like, where did that come from?
Yeah, that's good. That's good enough.
Shit. No, he's been around like older. I don't even know what to say.
Since before CDs.
Since before CDs, right.
Yeah.
And he has almost 20 albums out. He's incredibly unique as a player, writer, and a band leader. He's worked with Norah Jones. And I know who this is, and I listen to his music. I'm going to get this wrong. Most Def, is that just how you pronounce it, right?
Okay. Yeah.
John Mayer, D'Angelo, and countless others. He was also part of a very cool band called the Disposable Heroes of Hip-Hopracy. And TJ Kirk, which is a band named for the three musicians whose music it covered, which was jazz keyboard player Thelonious Monk, James Brown, and saxophonist Rahsaan Roland Kirk, and a few other projects. He is considered the authority on 7 and 8 string guitar, and he continues stunning audiences with his ability to simultaneously bust out tasty bass parts, melodic leads, and swinging rhythms. He's definitely got one of the most unique styles of playing I've ever seen. I can't even describe it. You've got to watch and listen to Charlie play. He plays both bass and guitar, very percussive playing, simultaneously on a 7 or 8 string guitar. And if you've never seen him play before, I would encourage you to check him out. He's got a very extensive website at charliehunter.com, and he's got a great YouTube channel. It is like nothing else you've ever seen or heard, and it just sounds freaking great. Man, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hey, really, well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I know this is out of order, but can you talk about...
You're out of order.
I'm out of order. This whole damn courtroom is out of order. My client... The Disposable Heroes of Hip-Hopracy, that was a really progressive concept, and I was curious how you got involved with them, and what was it like touring with you two, and did you actually learn anything, you know, being around or watching those guys, you two?
That's a great question. I mean, yeah, that band was, I was just in that band. I mean, I was, like I said earlier, I worked at Subway Guitars in Berkeley, which is kind of like a... Back in the 80s, 70s and 80s, that was the place where, you know, not only did you buy some cool guitar there, but it was a cultural connection kind of place. A lot of us had jobs there. Like I was telling you earlier, you said, hey, I just interviewed Alex Skolnick. And I said, well, yeah, that's my homeboy. Like, actually, we went to high school together, you know? And so Alex and I talked guitar at Subway Guitars. A great blues musician, really just, I would just say musician, named Alvin Youngblood Hart, he repaired amplifiers there because he had been in the Coast Guard, and so I think he was an electronics guy, so he did that. And Michael Franti repaired basses and guitars there. So that's how I met Michael. At the time, I had just come back from 3 years of being a street musician in Europe, and I was making, you know, playing at the gigs I could play and teaching guitar and working a job as a office furniture warehouse guy, which was serious. I've done every bad job you can probably have. And that was really intense and grueling, but the boss was really great and the people I worked with were really cool. So in any case, you know, I just was in a learning phase trying to become a better guitar player. It's not unlike now.
you're an amazing guitar player.
No, man. Every day you got to work on it because if you dip, drink your own Kool-Aid, that's the beginning of the end. There's always some glaring bad shit in your playing, mine especially. But so we worked there, and Michael Franti was like, hey, man, I write music. And he didn't write music because he didn't play music, but he's like, I write these lyrics, and do you want to play some gigs with me? So I said, yeah, sure. You know, so we started playing duo gigs where I did my kind of Tuck Andrews impersonation, and he did his lyrics over the top of it, you know. And we did a lot in the Bay Area, and actually, like, the first real big gig I ever played, like, in terms of, like, a lot of people was my friend Vernon Reed had us open for Living Color, and this is like
this
is like 1989 when they were like at the height of their thing, and it was a huge audience, and it was the first time I ever saw my name in print or anything, and it was really great. I didn't own an amplifier, you know what I mean? Like Vernon was like, you can use this one. It was like a big Marshall amplifier or something. He's the best guy. But so anyway, Michael and I we were hanging out a lot. We worked together. And, you know, he was like, listen, I'm putting a real band together. I just got to deal with Island Records. Do you want to come out on the road? And I was like, well, I don't know. You know, I make $500 a week, teaching guitar and working at the used office furniture warehouse. And he's like, well, I can afford to pay you $500 a week.
Wow.
So I was like, no, man, I'm going to need $600 to go out on the road. I know, because I lived on the street for 3 years. I know what being on the road is like, you know. And he was like, okay, fine. You know, so we did that. And, you know, it was a great experience, not musically, because musically it was very limiting, because he and Rano were not musicians. They were writers and really performance artists, you know, and they were great at that. But the music, we had to play exactly the same thing every night to make sure that the performance itself came off great. And I didn't understand that at the time. I just wanted to play music. I didn't care about what the performance looked like. I was just like, I want to just learn how to play more Joe Pass, you know, or more Tuck Andrews, more Wes Montgomery. This is bullshit. I don't care about this. But in retrospect, it was a great experience because I got to go on the road as a guy who had been a street musician and a furniture loader and a ditch digger. And I got to go, you know, be on the tour with Billy Bragg and Arrested Development and go to Australia and do the Big Day Out. And we were on tour with U2, like you said. So I got to be playing all of these big, you know, football stadiums. And I got to see the highest high in the music industry up close. I had no investment in it. I was just a fly on the wall. I was just a hired guy. I could have been a security guy, or I could have been a driver. It was the same kind of the thing. It was exactly the same thing, basically. But what I learned was I don't ever want to be that. I don't want to be a big rock star. That's not the part of the music industry that I'm after. You know, if that happens, it's okay, but that's not what I wanted to do music for. And it was a real gift to learn that up close and have that experience and realize that's not for me. That way of presenting music is not, I'm not interested in that for me personally, but I understand it as a function and a, and I tip my hat you know.
Can you clarify that? Because you said, I don't want to be a rock star. If it happens, it's okay. Are you saying that basically you want to make music that evokes certain emotions coming from you and going to others without thinking about, can I sell this? Is that what you mean by that?
No, it's not that. I mean, it doesn't matter. You know, we live in a capitalist society. That's what we have at the moment. So that is the ages under which you have to kind of the lens through which you have to look at music. Because if you're not able to somehow sell something, you're not able to make a living, and you're not able to do what I love to do, which is play gigs for 100 to 200 people and really have a community and a communication.
Okay.
And what I love equally, which is to come into my shed and practice and work on getting better, so the next time I go back, those people can hear some improvement, you know?
Okay.
That's what's important to me. And but I'm saying, like, hey, if it happened, you know, if all of a sudden I go from playing from 100 people to 500 people, I mean, I'm not going to argue with that, but it's not really happening anytime soon. And that's okay, yeah, because yeah. I'm not the hare, I'm the tortoise, you know? And it was, you know, all of that to say that in retrospect, I'm so glad I had that experience. I'm so glad I met those people. I'm so glad I got to open shows for Public Enemy and Gangstar and Freestyle Fellowship and U2 and Primus and all these, and go on these big rock tours, like where you're meeting all these giant rock stars. I'm so glad I had to have that experience, but I also know that that world is not for me. That's just not.
Any funny stories that you could recollect from any of that?
You know, I mean, I'm sure there are some of them, but I just remember people you know, I mean, I just remember, you know, we were on this big day out tour in Australia, which was about 2 or 3 weeks, and I just remember somehow hanging up with Iggy Pop's band. And I would just hang out with those guys all the time. Why? Because they were just the coolest people, you know? Or I remember being on the road with Arrested Development, and Dion Ferris and I would always end up hanging out, because we were like the two. Dion Ferris and I and the drummer from Hypocrisy, Simone, would end up hanging out a lot because we were the music people.
Yeah.
You know? You know, I remember, you know, just being a fly on the wall backstage when we opened for Public Enemy a few times and being just like, wow, this is amazing just to be here, you know? You know, I mean, it's very interesting. It opened a lot of doors in terms of to be able to perceive stuff, but it did almost nothing for my career because I quit Hypocrisy, and I essentially, when I quit that band, I went back to moving furniture again. Mm-hmm. And then I got my own gigs in the Bay Area, and I kept working on being a better musician. And then, you know, within 2 or 3 years, you know, of playing every night, because there became so many clubs in San Francisco at that time in the early 90s, and so many opportunities to play. And I didn't feel like I was that good. But I got good just from playing every night, you know, and so I really had to start all over again, actually, because who cared? Nobody cared about disposable ears of Hypocrisy.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't the guy. Yeah. I was just an employee, you know.
Sure.
I could be the catering guy or whatever. But at the end of the day, I'm happy to have had that experience, you know.
How long have you been in New Jersey?
What seems like an eternity, especially since my taxes just went up. My wife and I moved from the Bay Area to New York in 97, and we moved from Brooklyn to here in 2002. So, wow, about 15 years.
Yeah, that's a long time.
Know?
What prompted
15
you to
years.
What prompted you to move from California to – that's West Coast to East Coast.
Well, my family's originally from New York. I spent a lot of time out here, and I also felt like I needed to get my ass kicked musically, and I had a lot of questions that I needed answered, you know. And I came out to New York and I got my ass kicked. And I came out to New York, I had a record deal with Blue Note Records. It wasn't like I needed for you know, the career advancement. But coming out to New York at that time, when there was still a little bit left of the old kind of guard and the old thing, you know, I came out to New York, I thought I was, you know, I'm going to be the next Wes Montgomery or the next Joe Pass. I'm going to be playing all this jazz. And I came out and I realized, like, well, you know what, maybe this isn't me. You know, I don't have an affinity for this so much, and maybe I'm not that good at it even. You know, what am I good at? What do I love? You know, and so you having all of these questions answered, and then you know what to work on, you know.
And that led you to developing the style of music that you own pretty much today.
I guess so. I mean, and I'm still getting better, thankfully, you know, because I hear stuff even from like 4 or 5 years ago, and I cringe, you know. So, but it's all part of the process.
Sure.
Thank God for the process, man.
Well, you got to be aware in the first place.
Yeah.
So you're obviously aware, so thank God for the awareness. That's,
you know. I guess so. Yeah, that's even better, right?
Yeah. If this is incorrect, let me know. I read online, and I always preface it with that because, you know, the barrier to entry to that is you could fog a mirror. I read online that you live in a commune in California with your mom and your sister. And my question is that true? And if so, how old were you during this time frame and what was that like?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, I lived the whole hippie existence. Mm-hmm. I mean, we, you know, my mom and her merry band of crazy people, and it was always a rotating cast, and there were lots of drugs involved. But we lived on a school bus for 5 years, just driving around the country.
Wow.
And this is in the, you know, early 70s,
yeah,
very early 70s. And eventually the school bus broke down somewhere. We ended up in a commune in Mendocino. We ended up at the hog farm. I mean, I'm like been in all of the hippie.
All the movies.
Every single place. I mean, my sister and I were there. And I was also in, when we finally ended up in Berkeley, you know, that's where you went if you really were unacceptable anywhere else in the country at the time. You ended up in Berkeley, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, anybody could move there. It's not like now. It's like an international real estate market now.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody could afford to live there. But when I was a kid, it was like mostly single moms and all kinds of different people. Yeah, I mean, what people think about today is like, oh, I want to live in a diverse town or multicultural. That's what we had.
Yeah.
It was because if you were too, different, if you were a product of a quote unquote mixed marriage, which is such an absurd thing to even say, that's where you went. You know, if you had political views that were a little to the left, that's where you went. You know, if you happened to, you know, want to live with your partner and you were the same sex, that's where you went.
Sure.
You know? So that's, we grew up with all of that stuff, all of the hippie kind of cultural thing. So I guess I crossed all of those off my list.
But you know, they're all crazy. Yours just had to be crazy living on a bus, but they were all fucking crazy. Even, you know what I'm saying? Mine wasn't living on a bus, but she's fucking crazy. So, you know,
you had the hippie upbringing too?
No, they're just crazy. But you know, that's what I'm saying. They're all some degree of fucking crazy.
Agreed.
Yours happened to be living on a bus. You know, mine happened to live in an apartment in the Bronx. You know, it's just different degrees of crazy, you know?
Totally, man. Totally. The Bronx is some real shit, too.
It was pretty real when I was a kid. I also read, again, online, that you studied with Joe Satriani, and I'm assuming it was at this place you work, because I know Alex studied there as well.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is that was at the other guitar store. There were two guitar stores, Subway Guitars and Secondhand Guitars was the other one. And my mom actually repaired guitars for both of those stores.
Your mom was a luthier.
Yeah.
Well, wow.
She repaired guitars. And the one that Subway was owned by a guy named Fat Dog, typical Berkeley hippie thing. He's still there, actually. Still operational, which is just bizarre to me. Because I think he owns the building. I don't think there'd be any other way.
Fatdog.com?
No,
no, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, yeah, who knows? You know, right? Probably. Yeah, you never know. No, but so then secondhand guitars was really a half a mile or maybe a mile at most away from Subway. So we would walk from one to the other, and they'd kick us out of one, and we'd go back to the other. But Joe Satriani taught at secondhand guitars, and he taught in a room that was like no windows in the back of the store, probably like just enough to fit two adult males in it without before the body odor got to be too intense. Yeah. You know what I mean? And he was great. He was a great, great teacher. And I remember, you know, going there, and I was pretty good. I was about 14, you know, and I thought, you know, I thought I knew something. And I went there, and he was a guy who I thought was like a grown man, came out of the room, and he was in tears. He was probably an 18-year-old, you know what I mean? When you're 14 and you see someone, you think they're... And I was like, fuck, if that's not happening to me, that motherfucker, I'm going to show him I know how to work, you know? All right. And I went in there, and he was really cool, you know? He just is like, and I came back, he gave me all this work. I came back the next week, and I had my shit down, and he was like, all right, we can work. And the thing which was so cool about Joe that people don't realize, you know, let me know if you have any specific questions about him, but, you know, the thing that people don't realize is that he taught everybody, all styles. It did not matter. So many people learned from him. So many different kinds of guitar players. And the thing people, they know him for, like, I guess what you kind of call, like, his kind of guitar hero-ish kind of thing and what he does, you know, what he does. I mean, I don't know.
Shredding, tapping.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is that is like, I was surprised when they said, oh, Joe Satriani, check this record out, like in the 90s. And I was like, oh, okay. I heard him do that occasionally, you know. Oh. That's a small, but people don't understand that that's just a tiny, tiny fraction of what he, I don't want to say it's a tiny fraction. It's where he's logically wound up at in terms of a career and his musicality. But this is a guy that studied with Billy Bauer and Lenny Tristano in New York City. This is a guy that played in Latin bands in the Bronx. Mm. This is a guy that played with blues bands, you name it. He could really play anything. And he had a deep appreciation. I mean, he took me to see Alan Holdsworth when I was like 14 years
old.
Wow,
how cool
is that? Of
course,
I didn't know what the hell was going on. I still don't understand. You know, ultimately, I'm just like, what the hell is going on here? Too much. But I mean, I was sitting like 10 feet from his Marshall amp, you know, getting my head blown off. And I loved it, of course. But I was just like, this is the craziest LSD trip I've ever been on, you know? But the thing people don't realize about Joe is that he had no agenda whatsoever. His only agenda for the players was that you knew how to get around on the instrument. And you really knew how to get around on the instrument. The physical implication of playing your scales, your arpeggios, and chords, and how to actually play the instrument. No bullshit. No musical agenda. You would come to him and say, hey, man, I really want to learn this kind of thing. He goes, okay, let's take this apart technically.
Yeah.
And I think that was a really, really wise thing for him to do, because all of the people that you know that studied with him can all get around on the instrument technically. I mean, I'm a real outlier for that group of people. Because my shit is so far away from it. But, you know, I remember when I was a street musician in Europe and going around playing guitar, people, other guitar players, man, show me that crazy thing you did. I was like, that's not a crazy thing. It's just what everyone in Berkeley does, because everyone could play. And right. I mean, everyone could play. I didn't even make it in the Berkeley High Jazz Band. I was like the third guy. You know?
Wow.
Yeah.
So it was like a Nashville almost kind of situation there.
Yeah, I mean, you had everybody there and every kind of music, and just in that little town alone, there were like 10 nightclubs, you know? So
Very
anyway,
cool.
that's the Joe Satriani thing. And he used to take me to his rehearsals. He had a band called The Squares, and he used to take me to their rehearsal studio, and I would just kind of sit there and hang out, you know. But he's a good dude. And he also knew that I think he also knew I didn't have a dad, and that there was a lot of fucked up stuff going on in Berkeley at that time. And he was like, this kid, who knows, maybe he'll eventually learn how to play guitar. Maybe I should invest a little time in him, you
That's
know.
nice. So he took you under his wing as a bit of a mentor as well, in other words.
Yeah, totally. I
That's
mean,
really
it's been
nice.
many, many, many years, but he's a good dude, man.
Have you ever ran into each other as adults?
Yeah. I had a short-lived podcast I did with my friend Adam Dorn, where it's called Compared to What Podcast. We kind of finished it. We wanted to interview people we thought of, even though Joe's really only 10 or 15 years older than me. We wanted to interview people who we thought of as the generation above us, because we wanted that all of that learning and knowledge and culture to be preserved in some space. And so I interviewed Joe for that. It was fun.
Did you guys get to share memory? Was your relationship as adults? Because sometimes I don't know about you, but I've met people from the past, and I was a real as a kid, not a very contrary, and I always cringe when I meet people because I'm like, oh my God, and I hope this guy doesn't remember what an ass I was,
Yeah,
and I'm always like. And so, and this wasn't the same situation for you, but the same mentor, student, big brother, little brother kind of thing.
definitely,
Did that
definitely.
carry? Did you have that?
Yeah,
Yeah,
oh yeah,
that's nice.
totally,
That's
totally,
nice.
totally, totally, yeah.
That's
He's a
nice,
good
man.
dude.
That's really
He's a
cool.
good dude.
You wonder then if the reason why, like you said, that's what he became famous for, if that just happened to be, that was the market gap that the quote the industry was looking for, and he happened to have that at the right place at the right time because clearly he could do anything.
Yeah, but he was also doing that approach way before anyone else was. So, you know, like a lot of people, they'll say, "Oh man, I don't like all this Michael Brecker stuff." And I'm like, "Well, did you listen to Michael Brecker? Don't listen to people who play, like, listen to Michael Brecker. Ah, oh, man, I don't like that David Sanborn approach. Did you check David Sanborn out? Maybe listen to David Sanborn, you know?" And it's the same thing. It's just like, "Oh, okay, well, did you listen to like one of his first couple of records? Because that shit is like 1985, you know, or
To me,
86, something."
that's my favorite stuff of his,
Yeah,
to be
you know
honest
what
with
I
you.
mean? So, like, listen to that before you get all up in arms, you know?
Very cool, man. Thank you for sharing that.
My pleasure.
Charlie, you have a real technically and melodically advanced style of playing, and I know you're self-deprecating, so don't say anything. Just say thank you.
I don't know about that, but I appreciate it.
My question is, how and when did this start to develop? And also, this might be a silly question, but when you do something so original like that, how do you even know what to practice? You know what I mean? You're doing something basically brand new.
Yeah, those are really good questions. I'm sorry, were you done with the?
Totally, totally.
Yeah, those are great questions. I mean, I don't really think I'm that advanced melodically or harmonically. I'm
You're
pretty.
not listening to me.
I
I
think
said,
I'm.
just say thank you. Don't tell
No,
me.
no, no. I mean,
Wow.
for you know, when I think about people who like, you know, I was introduced to you from Mark Lethierry. I mean, those guys like Mark and the snarky guys and the people of that generation. They just woke up and learned all that shit, and then they're part of that gospel thing, which is so advanced harmonically. I really don't consider myself like I want to take lessons from Bobby Sparks. I don't know, you know Bobby, he
Keyboard
plays, and
player?
he's fucking amazing.
Yeah,
Like
I
his
gotta meet
harmonic
him.
sense. I heard him playing, and I was like, I felt like I was a kid because I was like, I don't understand this. Like, I actually don't. It like. intellectually, I'm kind of like, these are questions I don't have answers to.
You don't have the right question yet.
And I didn't even know I had a question until I heard it, you know? but I think that in terms of like what I do, it's really coming. Of course, I learned the jazz stuff. You know, I learned the Charlie Parker solos and the Thelonious Monk music and Coltrane music and Wes Montgomery and all that stuff. And I'm grateful that I learned it, and I learned it, and it was really hard. But that's not where I live so much. It's, you know, you get part of it, and those are just suggestions. And then they present you with questions. And when I first started on my instrument, when I don't play the eighth string, and I have not in, I don't know, 10 years probably, maybe more. But when I first started playing, you know, my instrument, I was like, well, what the hell do I do with this now? Like, I was a street musician, and I added an extra string, and it was like a George Van Epps thing, like a regular guitar with a low A, and I was like, well, what do I do now? I was like, okay, so I take this Tuck Andrews stuff and this Joe Pass stuff, and then I kind of add this extra string on it, and then that opens that, and then when I started to play the eighth string, which was a totally different tuning, I'm like, well, what do I do with this? You know, and I was like, well, you know, what is, now I need to learn how to play all these really hard jazz lines on the guitar with bass notes below them, and who does that? Well, let me check out, of course, all the bass players, because I played bass, you know, and then let me check out organists. So early on, I was like, oh, I want to learn the Jimmy Smith shit and Larry Young. Like, I need to learn how to play all this stuff. So that was like where I started, and then I went down this, because all the people I was hanging out with were real jazzers, and I was always felt like I was not really, not keeping up, but I just didn't have so much of an affinity for that. But I didn't know it because I was so overmatched technically. You know, my instrument was so hard, there was no, kind of like template for it. So yeah. I was checking these organists out, and then I felt like, well, wait a minute, why are they... People are saying, oh, you're not as good as this guy. And I'm like, well, okay, but I don't play that instrument. Like, I don't understand. What am I supposed to do here, you know? And it was real stressful. And then I got that Blue Note deal, and I was like, all right, I need to shred these things, and I need to be super technical and play, keep up with these horn players. And it was a hell of an education for me, you know? But I always felt like I was always kind of like, you know, trying to keep up, you know. And then years go by, and I learn some of this stuff, and I start realizing, like, well, wait, what does this instrument do? Like, now I know it. I've been playing it long enough. I've developed some technique on it. What is this thing supposed to do? And I realized, like, well, I've learned through trial and error that it's not supposed to be a vehicle for blazing linear kind of expression. It's not supposed to be a vehicle for on either the guitar or the bass side. It's not going to be a vehicle like a keyboard with infinite harmonic capability. What is it? And then I went back to, well, wait a minute. You know, it's all about where it resides is in the rhythmic counterpoint and the groove aspect of it. And that's where I need to really redouble my efforts, you know. But the good thing about that was, you know, growing up around my mom, she had and knew a lot of the old country blues guys. So those records were always on around my house, you know, Robert Johnson, Mississippi John Hurt, Joseph Spence. I mean, not Mississippi blues, obviously, he's from the Bahamas. Blind Blake, Lead Belly, all that music was the kind of music of my childhood. And I realized something clicked in my head, and I was like, wait a minute. My instrument is coming from there. Really, you wouldn't know it to listen to it stylistically, but in a conceptual, technical kind of way, well, that's really where it's coming from, and that's what it's supposed to do. And then, I mean, it's about 10 years that I've really, really doubled down and really have tried to create something different. And when you do that, it just takes a lot of work. And also, everything I'm working towards is like what I like to call covert. It's not going to really impress anyone or dazzle anyone. I spend hours of every day playing a groove on the drum set or like this instrument, this pandero or shakers, just so I can really understand what the groove is supposed to feel like. And then I try to put that on my instrument. And, you know, it's not one of these things where anybody's really going to be like, oh, it's amazing, look at that flurry of notes or whatever. But it matters to me because that's what I think of at for my own truth. That's my truth. But it took a lot of, not courage, it just because, you know.
No,
just
I think courage I think independence and courage is probably the right word.
Yeah, I guess.
Fortitude, you know.
You know what? You got to be vigilant. And
yeah.
It took me saying, you know what? I'm going to take this bizarre thing and make it even more bizarre by really cutting the link to worrying about what a bass player does and what a guitar player does. And just try to do what this does. And you know, once I did that, it was like, it's great. I mean, it's not great for money because if you're not playing stuff that people are used to seeing, it gets to be a little bit more of a hard sell. But I wouldn't, at this point, I wouldn't trade it for the world. And like you said, you know, I tell people, man, if I had known how much work this was going to be, maybe I would have done something differently.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you know, it's all about the journey. And I mean, I'm 50 years old and I wake up giddy like a 14-year-old. Like, not, I can't wait to get to the shed to try to figure some new shit out. And that to me is like the gift that keeps on giving, you know what I mean? And it wasn't always like that. There were mornings I'd wake up and be like, I hate this shit. Why can't I just be a Telecaster player? I hate this shit. I hate this shit. I wish I was a better drummer. Or how come why don't I just play acoustic bass? Or why don't I just quit music altogether, you know? But, you know, now I just, you know, I'm really honored that I can even, like, be a part of this music continuum, you know?
Wow, man, that is like the best lesson I think anybody who's a musician could ever listen to, the last 10 minutes of you.
Oh, really?
Oh, my God. Yeah, man, let me tell you why. Because you actually went back and thought about things, about the connection between you and your instrument and the world, and then made an evaluative decision as to where you want your place in that to be. And then you are constantly working hard to own that. And
yeah,
to me, that is not just musically, but I think anybody that owns a business, plays an instrument, or does anything on their own needs to go back and listen to that. And that awareness thing that, you know, your fucking awareness meter is very high, man.
Oh, thank you, man. I appreciate that.
Holy shit. That was,
maybe sometimes it's too high. And I think that comes to my Jewish side, my Jewish half, which is just like this.
That's a blessing and a curse.
It is. Yeah. Do you have that as well?
I overthought a lot when I was younger.
Yeah.
Around when I turned 50, I'm 54, I started making some conscious decisions about things like that related to how much stress in my life is on me.
Yeah, exactly. Like how much, what you actually have control of, which is very, very little, you should really, really actually deal with that.
Right. And I just decided to let a lot of shit go. And like, you know, I just realized that, you know, happiness is the number one priority for me, just for me.
Mm-hmm.
Happiness is the number one priority. And I need to really focus only on those things that contribute to that. And overthinking and worrying about minutiae definitely did not do it. And I really, and in business, I just came to the conclusion, like, done is better than perfect.
Yeah.
And that's not to say I've ever, you know, done any work or performed anything half-assed, quite the contrary, but I need to live a life, and I need to be happy, and I need to just let shit go. And I know with the effort and intensity I put into things that if it's, you know, fucking 90% of my best instead of 120%, that without sounding arrogant, it's still going to be like 95% of the rest of my peer comparison.
Sure.
You know, and I just wanted to focus more on shit that made me happy.
Yeah, you know, you get one little fucking spin. You know, might as well do that's the best you can. With
Charlie, that's exactly what it came down to. And I'm like, you know what, man, how many – and it, just like I said, when I turn – and I think it's not uncommon when you turn – you know, you're a few years behind me. You know, you start thinking more along those lines of, you know, man, I don't really have maybe another 50 left probably. But I want the next 50 or the next X whatever to be better than the first 50, you know.
Totally. Amen.
So that's just what I started thinking of, man. But that was wonderful, man. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you, man. I don't know.
I see Plan B as a Charlie Hunter self-development guru.
No, thanks.
On the horizon. Come on, you gotta.
I don't think so.
That'll tie right back into the Berkeley shit, man. You know, the prodigal son comes home.
But the second you get paid for that is when it's all void, you know.
Oh. 18, you moved to Paris, and this is, I'm assuming, where you said a few times you lived on the streets. I was curious what prompted that move and what the hell was that all experience like?
Well, I wasn't 18. I you know what, I was more 19. I think I was 19.
Okay.
You know, I had a friend that I grew up with, this guy, Thomas Hollier, and who is interesting dude. He actually came from France when he was 14. He was fucking up apparently so much in Versailles where he lived that his mom was just like, please take this kid. And he came to live with his dad who lived in the States. And we were homies, you know, we hung out all the time. And he said, you know, I was kind of just practicing and also kind of floundering. I didn't go to school. I was just trying to learn how to play guitar. He's like, man, you know, you want to go to Europe? My sister has an apartment in France, in Paris, that's going to be open for like a month and we can stay there.
A flat. Like, we have a flat.
Yeah. So I was like, good, let's do this. So I saved up my money and got a plane ticket and I brought a mouse amp with me. I was prepared, you know. And then we went and her apartment was awesome. It was a tiny little room. And I was there just long enough, and I started playing on the streets and then the subways, and I met people. And then by the time it was time for me to leave the apartment, I went, you know, I had met a bunch of people and just was playing on the street all the time. And it was great, man. What a great experience. Like, I was in Paris, and I met a bunch of people. We went to Zurich, Switzerland. I spent a lot of time in Zurich, Amsterdam, Berlin, Nice, time in Italy. Really all over the place, and it definitely, I was playing like, you know, anywhere from 8 to 12 hours a day on the street with great musicians, and I learned a lot. I mean, that was like a hell of an apprenticeship right there, you know.
Wow. I'm assuming you learned French within a couple months?
Yeah. My French was pretty good. It's not fantastic now because I never have a chance to. I took a course in the adult school here just to keep it up, and the teacher was like, "Nah, you're too good for French 1. I have to bump you up to French 2." You know, which was I was like flattered, but the fact of the matter is, my writing is reading comprehension was just garbage. You know, I learned on the street.
Oh yeah, in school they make you. Know you what I mean?
Yeah. So I didn't even really know how. Half of the shit I was speaking was spelled.
Yeah.
And then I went to Zurich and I learned some German in Zurich and I was okay. I wish I had an opportunity to get the languages more together because that's super gratifying and really fun and really uses a certain part of your brain that just kind of keeps you young. You know what I mean? Someday, who knows?
So when you were there, this is a non-Charlie Hunter question that you want to answer. So if you don't, just tell me. Because you were the American musician, I would imagine women were like fascinated by it.
Oh, no, not at all. I was so bizarre. I was way too intense. I don't think I cared at all about my appearance. I was totally only interested in music and practicing all day, playing all day, learning music. And plus, I was a street musician. It's, you know, we were our own group of people apart, really, from everybody else. We had our own places we hung out at. We did our own stuff. And those are still my friends 30 years later.
You still talk to these guys?
Absolutely, guys and gals. And great musicians from all over the world. That, I mean, that's where I really learned how to play, you know.
Where were you living?
Well, you know, sometimes you'd sleep in a train station or a park, but for the most part, you'd make enough money during the day to get like a little pension, which is like a nun's, like a little hotel that run by nuns. Okay. And you'd live in a room with a bunch of people or a hostel.
Oh, okay, like a youth hostel.
Or occasionally people would hook you up with a place to stay. That happened. Okay. You met the best people playing on the street. And in a lot of ways, it still to me is like the most pure way of presenting music, you know, because you just go, you don't know who your audience is, you just start playing and people stop and people listen. People, you get in conversations with people. I met the best people from all over the world, and I met the coolest musicians. I mean, when I was first in Paris, I hooked up with these two guys from Iran who they had just, this is like 1987, and they had escaped from Iran. They were intellectuals. One guy was like a physicist. Another guy was a philosopher, and they played music on the streets, and they killed it. Guy played the drum, and another guy played like a dulcimer kind of thing, hammer dulcimer. Amazing. So I got to hang out with those guys. I learned their whole life story. Like, one of my best friends is from Africa. But great musician. His life story is interesting. Another guy who's still my friend, and we still play together, is this guy, Tamango, who's like a world-class tap dancer, you know? And wow. And we still play together. He's all over the place. And my friend Dom Richards, who was a bass player, he played with Ronald Shannon Jackson for many years. You know, and the guy who played on my first couple of Luno records, Calder Spanier, he was a guy I met playing on the street.
Wow.
In Zurich. And I mean, just all these great musicians, man. And from all over the world, all different cultures. And it was a hell of a thing. I'm really feel lucky to have been a part of that event. Right place, right time, you know?
Two questions on that. What guitar were you playing? Were you playing electric guitar or acoustic or both?
Electric. And the funny thing is I went over there, I had saved my money working jobs, and I bought... I remember going into Guitar Center in San Francisco and buying an Ibanez George Benson. I thought it was the coolest guitar I'd ever seen. Mm. I thought George Benson was the greatest. And I remember playing it, and I just always remember, like, God damn, I can never get a good sound out of this guitar. And every time I'd play, like, a Strat or a Telecaster, I'd be like, this guitar sounds really good. And I was always like, but I was always like, no, I got to play the one that looks like jazz, because I like jazz, you know. And so I had that guitar. But when I went over there, I met a group of guys, and I ended up playing acoustic bass in that band, in that group, which was really great for learning. Turned my hands into hamburger, but it was great for learning. That was it. I mean, yeah, that's the guitar I went over there with, and I think I sold that to someone. Who knows what happened, man, you know.
Second question I had is, your son comes home today and says, Dad, I want to go to Paris and be a street performer. What are you saying? What's your response to that?
I'd say, man, all the best to you. You might want to think about making a time machine first, because I don't think you're going to have a lot of luck these days. And if you do make a time machine, being a musician in Paris is probably low on the list. Yeah. So I don't know, you know.
Just curious. That was it. That's fun, man. So what made you come back to the States?
Well, you know, I just felt like I had outlived my use. That experience, I wanted to take my career to the next level, whatever that meant.
Yeah.
You know, I felt like I was pretty good, and I wanted to come back And I went back to the Bay Area, and I really wanted to learn. I didn't have any formal education. And I went to Laney College in Oakland, which is community college. And I learned arranging and how to read and write music a little better. And, you know, all these, the real kind of basic things. And I never really particularly got fantastic at any of that, but enough so that I didn't feel like I was always going to be the, you know, country cousin kind of thing.
Sure.
It was an era that kind of came to a close. A lot of friends of mine that were there, everyone just kind of dispersed. It just, those things, they just happen.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a beginning and a middle and an end. The same thing with our scene in the Bay Area, the same thing happened. It was just this incredible scene for a while, and then the dot-com thing happened, and everyone was priced out, and then it just kind of ended,
yeah.
You know? And that's natural.
Yeah.
You know, those things are natural, I think. It's a natural kind of ebb and flow to things.
Yeah, it is. And it's interesting because it's interesting just to see that in your own life, like, oh, okay, this is time to move on.
Yeah.
And I find sometimes if you don't move on, you're in trouble.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I agree.
Are you working on anything now that's got you excited?
Well, I've been playing with a couple singers, and I have like a group I've been doing now because I was playing with this woman, Silvana Estrada.
Hmm.
I don't know if you heard that whole story, but I was down in Mexico. You heard the story about a year and a half ago, and she was a student of mine. She's a 19-year-old singer-songwriter in this jazz kind of camp kind of thing. And I was like, whoa, you're really, really good. Like, what the hell, you know? And then I went down there with a friend of mine, and we made a record of her and these two guys that were playing, this great drummer, this guy Alex Lozano, and a bass player, Octavio Alvarez. And they're young. They're like 18, 19 years old. And we made a record, and Silvana sang her ass off, played cuatro. She came here. We made another record with she, myself, and Carter McLean, great drummer. And, you know, and then we're supposed to tour last December. And we went through all of the proper channels. I got a lawyer. I got a, you know, we got to get her a visa. And it was what's called a non-immigrant work visa. Really easy, just like, look, I'm an employer. This woman does something very particular that
right.
actually only
nobody
she
else can
do.
Yeah.
Which is totally truthful.
Yeah.
Nobody else can.
Sure.
And after the first time, she was denied by Homeland Security, because Homeland Security are the people who issue the State Department just like issues the visa. Homeland Security decides whether you can take it to that process. And she was denied. And then the lawyer assured us that this was totally insane. So we tried again for a tour in February. She was denied again. And it cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
So it cost me a lot of money. Then I don't know if you heard, but the woman from Bocante was just denied to come in and tour the United States.
I heard.
And that's what's going on right now, basically, Homeland. It's a total mess. All that notwithstanding, it put me in a situation where I was like, well, wait a minute. I got to play with a singer now. I got to figure this shit out. And I contacted Lucy Woodward, who's a great singer. And she and I and Keita Ogawa, great percussionist, we did this tour in February. I was like, I like this. I like this singer shit. This is cool.
Mm.
And then I tapped another friend of mine, Dara Tucker, who's a Nashville-based singer, to do tour with me, and a percussionist, Damon Grant. So I kind of mix and match those groups depending upon who's available.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And I really like it. It's really fun for me.
That's cool,
you know?
Man. The next tour you got coming up? You're going to have...
Yeah, the next tour I have will be with Lucy and Damon. And I have a tour with Dara and Keita coming up. And Lucy and Keita as well. So, yeah, it's just, it's really fun. And, you know, I enjoy it. I like just sitting in the groove as much as anything, you know.
Well, you're a percussive player ultimately,
yeah.
So you know,
yeah,
this totally makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's where I'm coming from.
I'm available to sing, just FYI, Charlie.
You got it, man. You got it.
We'll have fun. I don't know if anybody will come and listen, but we'll have fun. let me ask you this. You know, we all pay tuition of some sorts in our careers, and I was curious if you'd be kind enough to maybe share one or two mistakes that you made along the way and what lessons you learned from them.
In terms of what kind of mistakes, like,
not like mistakes in your playing, but, you know, like, for example, people have said things like, I'm just throwing examples, people have said things like, you know, one mistake I made is one time I came to a gig unprepared. I thought I was the shit. I thought I knew it. And I got my ass handed to me. And that was the first and last time, you know, stuff like that. Like,
You know, I think that, you know, there's plenty of mistakes to go around. I think that I could have been a little more laid back when I was first signed to Blue Note and Warner with TJ Kirk at the same time, but I just was really stressed out. So I think I just probably came across as a little too intense. And
you?
Ready to throw
no,
down.
No, I don't see you being really? Coming across as too intense. That's
stuff. Yeah, I think
so. I find
so.
That hard to believe, Charlie.
But, you know, also, yeah, just thinking like those same things happen to everyone.
Yeah.
You think you're the shit and you're just like, well, it turns out maybe I'm not so great, you know. But, yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to think of the mistakes I've made, you know.
And maybe there haven't been any, you know.
I think there have been, but, you know, I think we're taking chances all the time as musicians, and I think you just feel like there's always going to be mistakes, you know, and that's just part of the process, you know.
Yeah.
And if you're not making those, you're not dealing with
You're probably the not process. Taking enough chances.
Yeah, I think so.
That's in any business, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
If you can go back and give advice to younger Charlie, assuming younger Charlie would have accepted it, what advice do you think you would have given yourself?
You know, don't worry so much, but it wouldn't have mattered because I think you're just going to worry when you're a musician, you know, at least I did, you know,
I think everybody does when you're younger.
Yeah.
Man. It's funny. My son is 28 and,
wow.
He called me up yesterday and he just got a new job and it's like you know, moving in a career kind of thing, and he was like all nervous and everything. And he wasn't telling me he was nervous, but he was just talking.
You could tell.
I knew he's nervous. And so I sent him a text afterwards, after talking, a couple of hours later. I said, hey, Nick, just let you know, just take it 1 minute at a time. I said, everything's going to work out. You're going to do great. I said, just allow, you know, just enjoy every minute and just do the best you can and it'll all work out. You know, and he sent me and he said, thanks so much, Dad. I love you. You know, and I was like,
oh, that's nice.
Yeah, I felt really good because I don't know if he's going to listen.
Yeah.
You know, he's going to go in there and still be a fucking mental patient maybe. But at least I felt like, okay, he knows I've got his back and that kind of thing about don't worry so much. You know, I think it's important and it's hard to be in that, you know, he's got a daughter and, you know, his own family. So I get it, you know, so.
Yeah.
But don't worry. It's such a, like a simple thing, but not easy to do when you're young.
Totally, totally true. Totally true, man.
Hey, I want to talk about your gear just for a minute.
Okay.
I would assume all your guitars are custom made.
Yeah, they are.
Can you talk about like your top two or three maybe?
Sure. I play the one I play the most is this Jeff Traugott one. And Jeff Traugott's like known for making really expensive flat top acoustic guitars. And you know, I was playing guitars that Ralph Novak did for years, and then Jeff made me this really nice acoustic guitar, which I don't really play. I mean, I love playing acoustic guitar. He made me kind of like an 8-string acoustic, and it was just like, all right, this is, I don't know what I can do with this, you know. And eventually I was just like, dude, just make me an electric. And so he made me electric, which I played for a really long time. And then the one I've been playing is one of his that I think he made last year. And so there's that one. And then the other guitar I play is by Wes Lamb, and he's down in North Carolina. And he and I and this guy Clay Connor and Wes's partner, because Wes is also the pre-war guitar, that he does that. And so they have this whole workshop down there, Luthier's Workshop in North Carolina. And, you know, I had so many people asking me, hey, I want to play this instrument, but I can't afford, you know, to get one. So I went to Wes and I was like, Wes, I want to come up with kind of like a universal seven-string guitar that people can buy that will be a great professional grade instrument, but not break the bank, so to speak. Like, can we come up with one like at a $2,000 price point, you know? Because he has a CNC machine, everything, you know, because what's hard is getting those fan frets lined up correctly. So we did. We came up with one, and there's two versions of it. It's like, I call it the Universal 7 because, unlike my guitar, although it can have two sets of pickups like mine, it has one pickup with seven pole pieces that you can assign.
Oh, wow.
Right? So this comes with two jacks. So you can do three and four like I do. You can have a switch so that all seven are one jack. You can do whatever you want with it, really. Just like with a soldering iron and someone who knows what they're doing. And so my whole deal with it was like, we'll make the scale length so that it can be used for a lot of different things. So let's say you get this guitar and you're using my tuning and you're like, you know, this is not for me. I'll be like, okay, well, try this. Why don't you try doing a George Van Epps tuning on it and just switch it to the one jack so you can put everything through one amplifier? Then you're all of a sudden like, oh, wait a minute. I do like this, you know? Or do you want it to be like kind of a weird baritone guitar? Do that, you know?
Wow.
So basically, if you spend the money on the guitar and you don't like what it is, you have three or four different permutations that you can do with it. And man, today with the design and the manufacturing, it's so, you get such a fucking great instrument for so little money. It's kind of crazy, you know? Now, so that's the other instrument I play, you know, and I'll play. I mean, I like this trap out. I just like, you know, how it feels and plays, and I'm used to it. But the Westland guitars are killer, and I play those often as well.
Now, you tune the top six strings are like a regular guitar?
No, that's a Van Epps tuning. My tuning is a little weirder. The genesis of my tuning began with the eight string, where I was tuning the lower three strings were E, A, D, and then the top five were A, D, G, B, E. So I had the full range of a bass and a guitar. What I did now is this, because the bass was always so short on that E and A that just were so floppy, you know, that I ended up tuning this so that the lower three strings are G, C, F, then C, F, B flat, D. So really, it's like the lower three strings of a bass starting on the third fret, and the middle four of a guitar starting on the third fret.
Man, you scientists need to study your brain, man.
Ha! I don't know about that.
It's
really not that weird if you think about it in terms of how the relationships are, because the relationships are the same.
The top four strings are G.
Well, the bottom. You mean you're talking about the highest?
The treble strings. What are they?
So from low to high, it's C, F, B flat, D. And then the low strings from low to high are G, C, and F.
Okay, so you have the same relationships as a standard guitar in those top four strings, correct?
The same
intonation.
The middle. Yeah,
okay.
The same. And the bass is the same as the lower three strings.
Wow.
But then there's a fifth in between the two, and it's a weird thing. But
wow.
You just learn how to deal with it and accept it eventually.
Are there any players that influence your playing that people might be surprised to hear?
Wow, I don't know. I mean, I really like so much guitar playing. You know what I mean? You know, for instance, someone is saying like, you know, we were just talking about AC/DC with a friend of mine. I was just like, I fucking love that. I fucking love the rhythm guitar in that band. I love it.
You know what's funny? I swear to God, I'm so sorry to cut you off. In my head, I'm thinking, imagine if this guy comes out and says AC/DC. I swear to God, that's what
really?
I was thinking. Yeah, because that was like, that'd be like the last thing I'd expect you to say.
I love it.
That's great, man.
I love Prince's guitar playing.
Oh, yeah.
Love it. I've just, I mean, all around everything he did. And then, you know, there's just so much stuff that I love. And it takes, maybe 10 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to say I love that stuff, because I think it takes courage to admit that someone does some shit a lot better than you do.
Well,
but that's,
you're such a talent, man. I don't think you can say whatever you want. I don't think anybody's going
to... People are able to do shit, and you're just like, you know, there's a point where it's either you don't have an affinity for it or you just don't have the technical ability to do it, you know. And it's okay to say that stuff. But
well, he's a very percussive player, Malcolm Young, so I could see your affinity for that.
Yeah, that's my shit. Yeah, man. I could see. I love that.
Yeah, the affinity, actually.
Yeah. I mean, you know. A lot of stuff, I mean, it's hard to say because there's just so much stuff that I really like. You know, what I really like is an era in music, I think, is because it's when I started buying records. It's like the late 70s. So, like, you know, there was this time when people are really interested in kind of soul music from the 60s, which, beautiful. It's great. You can't. Amazing. But I feel like there's a certain time period that's much harder to pull off. And that was the stuff like, you know, like that late 70s kind of era of R&B when you have, you know, like the Gap Band and Daz Band and LTD and Roger and Zapp and the Ohio Players and there was so much, and even that, the later Marvin Gaye stuff, and of course Stevie Wonder, but there was just so much great music happening, and Teddy Pendergrass, and I'm not an expert on that music, but I just really, really like that music, and just think there's just some, like a perfect kind of meeting. You know what it is, man? It's like the music I generally like has this real good balance between the visceral and the intellectual,
yeah.
You know? And you think about the AC/DC, it's mostly to the visceral side. You know, you think of that stuff and it's kind of, it's right in the middle, you know. It just like has a soul aspect, but the songwriting thing, and then this incredible technical proficiency as musicians and technical proficiency on like the recording and engineering side. When you listen to like those Brothers Johnson things, or you listen to like some of the great players like, you know, Tony Maiden, who played on that, Rufus and Chuck. Oh, man, Tony Maiden is the bomb. He's so great. That's the kind of stuff that really gets me going.
So would you listen to, or did you like a guy like Tommy Bolin?
Is that T-Rex?
Yeah, but that's the guy who played with T-Rex, but his solo career, and then he was with Deep Purple, he was with the James Gang, was much different than...
I don't think I know it. I don't know if I really know that so much.
He was a jazzer. He played with a band called Zephyr. I think he played with Billy Cobham, I think, was in that band.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. Well, I'll have to check that out for sure.
This is a tough question. Desert Island Discs, man. If I asked you to pick your top three, just for today, in no particular order, knowing it could change tomorrow.
Oh, my God. Wow, that's really hard. I mean, I always go to Blind Blake because I just think he's really one of the best guitar players that ever lived in a lot of ways. Oh man, it's really, really, really hard to do those kinds of things. Probably just for my listening pleasure, like I would probably want to have like one of those Wes Montgomery records with the organ trio. And then, I mean, man, it's really hard. It's hard to say. I just couldn't. It's too hard, man. I couldn't do that. You know what I mean? It's too difficult.
All good, man. What have you learned about yourself Charlie, through this journey. This has been such an exciting, adventurous journey for you, man. What have you learned about yourself?
Man, probably everything through this, because you really can't, if you want to really get deeper at this game, you can't hide from how lame you are, you know? and you have to embrace that shit, you know what I mean? You really, you're like, yeah, I thought I was more handsome than I was, you know? Or I don't mean that in a metaphorical
sense.
Yeah,
I understand.
You know what I mean? Like, oh man, I really thought I, you know, and then you start to drink your own Kool-Aid when other people say, oh man, you're really, really, really good. I'm just like, I don't think so, actually. Not yet. You know, it's going to take me a long time to get there, but it doesn't mean like I go out hating myself.
Yeah.
You know, I think that that's equally as lame and doesn't serve any purpose, but I think, you know, your reality is a hell of a drug. And when you go into the shed every day to learn more music, you're in danger of having a bad trip.
Yes.
Because you have to deal with yourself, you know. And yourself isn't always the best thing. It's not always making the best choices. It's not always doing the best things to people and to yourself, you know. You're not always being really great to yourself. So, you know, you better, if you want to dig deep into something, you better be careful, because there's a lot of stuff you're going to have to accept, you know. And I mean, I was talking to my friend Bobby Previtt the other day, who's like a genius drummer and writer, composer, you know. And he said, what are you doing? I got this singer's thing I've been doing. I said, you would hate it. You would just think it's the stupidest thing ever. But it's I like it. I really enjoy it. For me, it's great. And I don't care.
And that's,
you know what
that,
I mean? Like,
that's all that counts.
Like, you have to realize that about yourself. Like, yeah, I can be a pretty corny motherfucker at times. And you know what? Fine. That's totally fine. You know?
Man, I appreciate your, you're like brutally raw, honest. I don't mean that in any but a really supportive admiration way. No, because I think that is very refreshing, because it's easy to deal with someone like you, because I know if I ask you a question, I mean, forget about on this interview, if I ask you a question, I'm going to get an answer that's honest and truthful. And that's very, that's very easy to deal with, because even if it's not something I like, it's like, okay, it's genuine.
Right.
And there's a big comfort in that. I don't know
why.
Oh,
well, thank you, man.
Yeah, there's a very big calm,
you know, I don't know,
peace in that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, if you talked to me like 15 years ago, I'm sure I would have been more of a snarky douche. But,
yeah.
You know, now you take time and you dig into the layers and you know, that's...
Yeah.
That's,
yeah, yeah. That's,
yeah.
That's the outcome. I appreciate that, because it takes a lot of work. And when it comes down, it's harder to be that way,
when it comes down
to it, because there's a vulnerability that comes in, and there's a, you know, you have to have a bit of a, I don't give a shit what X person feels about my response, but it's real.
Yeah,
you know? I appreciate that. I like that. It's wonderful. It's best for me. The best way to be. I love that.
Oh,
it's like,
thanks.
Oh man, it's awesome.
Well, it's easier. You don't have as much baggage that way.
Yeah, it's that's exactly right. It's like, you don't have to remember what I say to this guy and how do I fix that story. I don't have that ability.
Right.
It's just like, fuck, I can't even, it's like I have a couple of buddies, man, and they have like, they're married and then they have like a couple of things on the side. And I'm like, I almost respect that in the sense like, wow, I'm overwhelmed with one woman.
Yeah.
I can't manage this one relationship as effectively as I like. How the hell are you doing three and the other two don't even know about? Wow. I mean, I need to fucking study that.
That takes a lot of energy.
It takes a lot of everything. And I'm like, wow, that's like I wouldn't do it ethically even, but like, I'm just like, wow, there's a talent in there almost, because I don't have that. You know, I'm like, gosh.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm like, no, it's a thing. You have to be wired that
no,
way.
Oh, you totally. You got to be totally wired. Yeah. But it's like, I don't even get it. Like, just the physics of it, the juggling. I'm like, how do you do that? I'm like,
man, I have no idea. I'd have an aneurysm within a week.
I wouldn't
be able to do that.
And then they're like, they're constantly like, the phone rings and like, deleting this message, you know, switching. And I'm like, holy shit, that's like remembering the keys, the combination of Fort Dix or something like that.
Yes,
Fort
exactly.
Knox. It's like,
yeah,
wow, yeah, that's, I need a sheet of paper, man. I can't.
That's some high level.
Yeah, it's like, wow. Yeah.
Chess. Multi-level chess.
Too much for me.
Yeah.
But anyway, the point is I appreciate the straight man very much easier.
Hey, my pleasure. Shit.
This is an interesting question for you. Best childhood memory.
Oh, wow. That's hard, man. You know, we never had really good food, you know. It's crazy. My best memory and one of my worst memories is, you know, because we always had, like, government food or hippie food.
Mm.
At the time, both were just horrible,
yeah.
You know. And I remember my first kind of day of school when I was in third grade in Berkeley. We, you know, it was a free lunch program, and we got to go into the lunch place, and they had sloppy joes, and I had never tasted anything so good in my life.
That's
and
cool.
I ate mine, and the guy next to me didn't want his. I was like, yes, this is the best shit I ever had in my life.
Awesome.
And I walked outside, and the California sun hit me, and I immediately threw it all up in front of a whole school right outside.
Hi, I'm Charlie.
Yeah, I wasn't used to it. You know?
Wow, that's wild,
yeah,
man.
Wow. Yeah.
Something or someone you miss from your childhood?
Well, I mean, dude, I'm 50. You're the same age. There's so many people that fall by the wayside, you know. I mean, I can't say, like, people I miss, because if people make an impression on you, you know, you miss them. But
yeah. But
if you had a real relationship with them, they stay with you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, you know, I can tell you there were people I grew up with that didn't make it. And it was a damn shame, because they didn't need to go that early,
sure.
You know. But you know, I mean, it's really hard to say, man. You know, there's a lot of people that aren't around anymore, and you know, you just hope that they're still in you, and whatever they imparted upon you or me, whatever information, whatever value that still lives within you. And your decision making has some of their DNA in it, you know.
Sure. What's your biggest business or personal win?
Poof. Boy, you know, I don't have a lot of business wins. I mean, I think just being able to stay in this thing is
a win. It is.
And, you know, kind of still, you know, I'm knocking on wood, having kids that aren't in, you know, that are doing okay in school and are kind of decent humans. I think that's a pretty personal win, you know.
I would agree with that, man, 100%. Do you have any hobbies or interests outside of music?
You know, golly, I mean, I wish I read a lot. I do a lot of crossword puzzles.
I knew you were a big reader, man.
Yeah, I wish I could do more. I just, you know how it is when you're raising these kids, you know, it's not like you don't have a lot of time for much else. I think music is my hobby as well as what I love to do. And so, you know, I think of the rhythmic of playing percussion and drums and stuff as the hobby part of it. You know?
Sure.
I like baseball. I like to watch baseball. Does that count as a hobby? That's a pastime.
That's a hobby for sure, man. Who do you like watching? The Yankees?
No, I'm a San Francisco Giants fan.
From back home.
No. These days. But I like the good game. Whatever the good game is that day, whatever the good pitching matchup is, I'm watching that. There's a guy I like to watch, like Mookie Betts. I love watching him. I'm not a Red Sox fan, but I want to watch him.
Right.
You know, or Shohei Ohtani, I want to watch him. You know, Altuve, I want to see him. So I'll watch those guys play, you know.
Very cool, man. Two more questions, and I'm going to let you go, and I really appreciate everything.
Hey, man, this is great. My pleasure.
Toughest decision you've had to make or hardest thing you've had to do?
Well, it always comes around to the same things, and that's always band personnel, you know. You know, you don't want to hurt anyone's feelings, and it's hard because everyone you play with is great, you know, but some people just have a better affinity or a disposition for a certain situation, you know, and those are always the hardest things and kind of like changing band personnel up. But, you know, I belabor that shit and I worry about it forever, but everybody always comes around and they're always more understanding usually than I am.
I get you. The short-term discomfort is far greater than any long-term pain you're going to
experience. Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Totally get that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the last question is, what's been the biggest change in your personality, let's say, over the last 10 years? And has this been deliberate and intentional, or has it just been related to age?
You know, isn't it hard to figure those things out? Like it's hard because we like to deal in absolutes, and it's really hard to have an absolute opinion about something when the train is always moving.
Yeah.
You know, and so you're aging. So your age has a big part in what your outlook is. My outlook right now is so different than it was 30 years ago. You know, you're just dealing with a whole different set of tools, you know.
Yeah.
But what I would say has been a blessing is that, you know, a certain amount of things are put upon you when you're making a living as a musician, and a bunch of different narratives. And you might believe one or two of the narratives. You might believe, oh, I'm not doing as well as I should be doing. I should have what this guy has. How come this didn't happen for me? And as you get older, you kind of are forced into a situation of realizing, like, well, this is your reality, and it's not too fucking bad. Have you had worse realities than this one? Hell yes, you know? And then you know some of these people who you look at and say, oh, they've got the world on a string, but you know, I was that guy at one point where, you know, I was on Blue Note Records and I was the guy, you know, for 4 or 5 years. I mean, and then I wasn't, you know, and that's all part of it. That's all part of the deal, you know. And, you know, there was a time where I was like, I think I'm done with music. About 7, 8 years ago, I was not able to get a gig, really. I was behind the eight ball financially because I had a few things happen with a manager and a booking agent, and I ended up like $30,000 in debt without a manager or a booking agent, and I had to figure a bunch of stuff out, and I was like, maybe this is it. Maybe I'm done with this music thing. I have to get a gig now, a job, you know. But, you know, things happened, and luckily I got some gigs, and I could continue to continue to kind of make a living being a musician, and you know, you also, as you get older, you start to realize, like, well, you know, you really have to own a lot of the choices you make. And I've had many, many chances in my career to be the guy, to be in someone's band, to do these things. And I always made what seemed like the right musical choice for me. And that doesn't always mean it's the right professional choice.
Money choice.
You know, exactly, yeah. So, you know, but hey, all things being equal, I'm just glad that I have a place to live and that I can get every day try to become a better musician, you know? And that's cool.
That's great.
Yeah.
And I want to congratulate you. You told me how long you've been with your wife?
Oh, man. seems like forever. man, like 24 years. Man, that's same as you, man. And congratulations to you as
25.
Well.
Oh, I know. But, you know, I thought that my wife was a had to be a saint. Now that I've met you, I think your wife.
Oh, yeah. Can you imagine it?
You're so – you know what it is? Because, like, my wife's always told me – not anymore. I'm definitely a lot more laid back. But she'll say, you know, you're not easy. You're real intense. I'm like, what? It's you getting what you, you know, it's no bullshit. She's like, but I'm listening to you. I'm like, fuck, that's a lot of work.
Yeah.
And, exactly. And if I do not mean that in any like negative way. Dude, it's just like.
And you know, when you're married, man, you know how much work it is for everybody consider.
Yeah.
You know, I'll tell you what, you know, one thing I learned about early on, when I was on tour and I was like complaining about someone and an older musician said, this is going to come to us as a shock to you, but they need a break from you as much as you need a break from them.
No fucking way, man. I'm like so easy to deal with. I'm really, I know.
You know, you're like 25 years old and you're like, your view of yourself is so completely you have no idea.
It's very myopic. It's very awareness is not what it should be. And
zero. Right, and I think you're technically you're supposed to have zero awareness at that age.
Yeah.
I think you're supposed to be completely because if you were self-aware, you know, when you think about things in terms of like evolutionarily, when we were all sitting in a little village in Africa 5,000 years ago or whenever it was, as humans, you know, in our tribe. If you were self-aware, you were going to be the guy who always overthought everything and never got the girl. And your fucking genes would just perish. Your DNA would just disappear.
Yeah.
You know? So I think the idea is like once you've done your inseminating and all that stuff, you get to be a certain age. You're like, okay, now I can be reflective.
Yeah, you know? Once you've done your inseminating, I love that.
Yeah.
Man, I cannot thank you enough for your time. You're really, it's been honestly a good pleasure, man.
Likewise, man. Thank you.
I want to tell people, first of all, if you have not heard Charlie Hunter, you need to go check him out right now. Go to his website, charliehunter.com. He is honestly just a brilliant musician. He does things with a guitar that you will have never thought are even possible. And his musicianship is awesome. His playing is brilliant, but unselfish. As a band leader and a writer, his stuff is extremely melodic, very tight, really easy to enjoy. And it's very eye-opening because it just makes you feel good. And you learn a lot musically just by listening to this because he has done things with others that you just never heard before and like you wouldn't have thought it's possible. It's like, you know, a new drink that you're like, wow, this is phenomenal. This is how you're going to feel about when you listen to him.
Oh, well, thank you, man.
You're welcome. That's not an ounce of exaggeration there. And I want you to support Charlie. Please go out and see him on tour. He's getting ready to do a pretty extensive tour. He's going out west, first around the Northeast and then out to California, I believe, and then you come working your way back.
Yep, yep.
Go to charliehunter.com. You can see everything about his tour. Listen and buy his records, and all the information is there on the site. And also, go follow him on Instagram. It's charliehunter67, CharlieHunter67, and connect with him there. He's a super cool guy. Man, any final words of wisdom?
No, man. I think I used them all up, whatever I But, well, dude, thank you. This was great. Great
thank
questions
you, man.
And great conversation. I appreciate it.
Likewise, man. I feel the same. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview and hope you enjoyed all the very cool stuff Charlie talked about as much as I did. Thanks so much to Charlie Hunter for spending time with us and for sharing his story. I definitely appreciate it. Go to everyonelovesguitar.com, get on our newsletter, sign up, get notified of future episodes. And this is important. Remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have some fun. Till next time, thanks for listening. Peace and love, and I'm out.
We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.